This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, September 23rd, 2008. From radio station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandasizwe Shimaringa, sitting in for Aura Bogado. Violence in Afghanistan surpasses Iraqi benchmarks. The Bush administration appears to reject congressional concerns about the massive Wall Street bailout. Those stories and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. 11 members of South Africa's cabinet have tendered their resignations in solidarity with President Thabo Mbeki. The ruling African National Congress forced Mbeki to step down due to allegations that he interfered in a corruption case against his political rival, ANC Chair Jacob Zuma. Mbeki is due to leave office on Thursday. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown gave the speech of his career today at his party's annual conference. The Labour Party is facing its lowest popularity ratings in decades, and rumors are rampant regarding a challenge to Brown's leadership. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Today's speech follows a week in which 13 Labour MPs, one of them a minister, called for a leadership contest, and two people resigned from their government positions. Four and possibly five cabinet ministers are said to be ready to urge Gordon Brown to stand down. Since Gordon Brown took over from Tony Blair, he's been dogged by criticisms of his leadership qualities. In today's speech, he made new policy announcements and acknowledged his mistakes.
I know that the way to deal with tough times is to face them down. Stay true to your beliefs. Understand that all the attacks, all the polls, all the headlines, all the criticism, it's all worth it if doing this job I make life better for one child, one family, and one community.
But it remains to be seen whether Gordon Brown's speech today can reverse his own fortunes and that of his unpopular government. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Bolivian President Evo Morales sent a proposed peace agreement to four opposition governors before leaving for New York to address the United Nations General Assembly this evening. Lenny Olivera files this report.
The president's proposal comes after a week of dialogue between the government and the opposition. For the Morales administration, a top priority in the negotiations has been ensuring that the Bolivian electorate will have the chance to vote on a new constitution in a nationwide referendum. The peace proposal calls on the governors not to block the constitutional referendum. Support for the president is strong among Bolivian voters. Last month, Morales survived a national recall referendum with a 67% margin of victory. Support for the constitutional referendum is also strong among Bolivian social movements, which have been blockading all access points to the opposition-dominated city of Santa Cruz. The blockaders have threatened to enter and protest in the wealthy city if the opposition governors continue obstructing the constitutional referendum. Morales says he can convince his supporters to end the blockade if the opposition signs the peace proposal. The opposition governors have until Thursday to sign the peace agreement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Olivera in Cochabamba, Bolivia.
A leading Burmese pro-democracy activist has been released after 19 years in prison. 79-year-old Win Tin has served more time as a political prisoner than any other Burmese dissident. He is a founding member of the National League for Democracy and was a close advisor to Aung San Suu Kyi, who was elected to lead the Burmese government but was prevented from taking power by the military junta. Speaking to reporters shortly after his release, Win Tin said he intends to continue his fight to end military rule in his country. Iraq war resister Jeremy Hensman was scheduled to be deported from Canada today. He faces a court-martial and up to 5 years in prison. But a last-minute hearing before a federal judge has won him a temporary reprieve. From Toronto, Kristen Schwartz has more.
Jeremy Hensman fled to Canada in 2004, just before his unit was deployed to Iraq. His application for conscientious objector status had been denied by the U.S. military. In Canada, his application for refugee status was also denied. But yesterday, Justice Richard Mosley ruled that he and his family could stay in the country until the federal court hears a new appeal. Hinsman's lawyer had presented new evidence that war resisters like Jeremy, who who are outspoken about their political beliefs may receive harsher punishment than other deserters. The attorney also argued that a previous ruling had failed to take into account the impact the deportation would have on Jeremy's wife, 6-year-old son, and newborn daughter. The hearing is expected to take place in the coming months. From Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
The state of Georgia is scheduled to execute Troy Anthony Davis tonight, despite widespread uncertainty of his guilt in the 1989 murder of a police officer. No forensic evidence ties Davis to the crime, and 7 witnesses who provided key testimony to convict him have since recanted. Georgia's Supreme Court has refused to grant Davis a new trial, and yesterday ruled against delaying his execution. Davis's supporters are calling on the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a last-minute stay in order to consider the case. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
In New York today, more than 120 world leaders converged for the opening of the United Nations General Assembly. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was the first of many to address the growing financial crisis.
We need to restore order to the international financial markets. We need a new understanding on business ethics and governance with more compassion and less uncritical faith in the magic of market. And we must think about how the world economic system should evolve to more fully reflect the changing realities of our time.
U.S. President Bush said the country was taking decisive action to address the financial meltdown and tried to assure world leaders the crisis would be defused. But that was later in his speech. He used much of his 22 minutes to push for multilateral cooperation on his administration's so-called war on terror.
We must see the terrorists for what they are. Ruthless extremists who exploit the desperate, subvert the tenets of a great religion, and seek to impose their will on as many people as possible. Some suggest that these men would pose less of a threat if we would only leave them alone. Yet their leaders make clear that no concession could ever satisfy their ambitions.
This was Bush's last speech at the UN, and he encouraged UN members to enforce sanctions on Iran and North Korea, while also attacking Iran and Syria as state sponsors of terrorism. Also speaking today was Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, president of Liberia, noting that in spite of the country's progress towards economic stability, they still have a long way to go towards eradicating poverty.
The presence of the UN mission in Liberia has given hope to the people not to surrender to the threat to peace and development that are represented by the large percentage of unemployed youth who cannot be absorbed by an economy still too weak in spite of the recorded high level of growth.
Every year, the UN General Assembly brings world leaders to New York City, leaders who might not normally be invited to visit the United States. This year, one such delegation is from Cuba. The most powerful Cuban leaders to visit the U.S. in several years, the delegation includes the vice president, foreign minister, and members of the Communist Party's secretariat. Vice President José Ramón Machado Ventura addressed several issues in New York Monday night, such as the 50-year-old trade embargo, international solidarity, and the case of 5 Cuban nationals imprisoned on charges of espionage. FSRN's Ari Paul was there.
José Ramón Machado Ventura is 78 years old and belongs to the Old Guard Cuban revolutionaries. He is a medical doctor, Cuba's first health minister, and now vice president of the country. Ventura has a mission in New York this week. Every year for the past 16 years, the UN General Assembly has approved Cuba's resolution calling for the U.S. embargo to be lifted, and this year such a vote is more crucial than ever. The 46-year-old U.S. trade embargo against Cuba is hurting the island's recovery from Hurricane Gustav and Ike. More than 300,000 homes damaged, 1/3 crops destroyed, 6-month-long food shortage waiting. Cuba is in big post-calamity crisis, says its officials. Among Ventura's many missions involved highlighting the need for aid, exposing the U.S. sanctions, and even making claims how effectively his government handled the evacuations with little resources. Last night, Vice President Machado Ventura spoke before 500 people at a church in Harlem, thanking those Americans who support lifting the embargo on the country. He also spoke about the connections both Cuban independence leader José Martí and Cuban revolution leader and former president Fidel Castro had with New York City.
Ustedes han reafirmado una vez más.
With your effort overcoming great obstacles, you have once again reaffirmed the friendship and support that the American people have always given Cuba.
La ciudad de New York tiene vínculos históricos con nuestro país. En esta ciudad, José Martí vivió.
New York City is historically linked to us Cubans. This is the city where José Martí lived and organized the necessary war. Fidel traveled here in 1956 to develop activism to prepare for the expedition that would land in Cuba to take freedom and light to our country.
The vice president's trip took place nearly 10 years after five Cuban nationals were arrested and eventually convicted on charges of spying on the American government. Cuban solidarity groups in the U.S. maintain that the five men were Cuban government operatives who had infiltrated anti-Castro extremist groups in Miami trying to gain information on future attacks against the Cuban government. Leonard Weinglass is an attorney for the so-called Miami Five and was confident that the Supreme Court would overturn the convictions.
They remain resolute and strong in the struggle for their own freedom. We feel that we have a strong position legally, and the wind is at our back as we now approach the Supreme Court, where for the first time, we will have nine judges, none of whom are from Miami.
The United States imposed a trade embargo against Cuba in 1962 after revolutionary forces toppled the Washington-backed regime and instituted a socialist government under the leadership of Fidel Castro. The embargo prevents Cuba from buying supplies directly from the U.S. and forbids purchasing any U.S. goods on credit. If Ventura's delegation succeeds in spreading the word around and manages yet another calling from the U.N. General Assembly for the embargo to be lifted, it would be seen as a big diplomatic success. But would these acts translate into something meaningful to the people on the ground in dire need of aid is a different question. In New York, this is Ari Paul for FSRN.
Ground reports from Afghanistan may challenge the argument of Republican presidential candidate John McCain that Iraq is the center of the war on terror. In the last 3 months, American and allied combat casualties in Afghanistan surpassed that of Iraq for the same period. And now Defense Secretary Gates is saying that more combat troops should be deployed to the area, but not until next spring. A resurgent Taliban is at large and the security situation is worsening day by day. International security forces enjoy little local support and struggle to survive as pockets of Afghanistan are increasingly becoming hostile. FSRN's Asma Nemati reports from Kabul.
They always said Kabul City is safe, but that's not entirely true. On September 13th, the Logar province's governor, along with his two bodyguards, were assassinated by a roadside bomb in the Parman district of Kabul, about 16 miles away from downtown Kabul. Also, 10 French soldiers were killed in the Sarobi district of Kabul about a month ago. The deteriorating situation in Afghanistan is hitting closer to the capital, and many people fear a renewed Taliban presence. Meanwhile, local Afghans are apprehensive about the overall security situation, and carrying on normal activities during such a time is difficult for families. Hafizullah Saleh, a night guard who lives in Kabul with his wife and two young children, expresses his fear.
When there's a suicide bombing, all the families are worried. We're extra careful when taking our children to school because suicide bombings happen here, and we're very afraid of them. We have to wake up very early in the morning to take our children to school, and the security situation in Kabul isn't good either.
The Taliban claim responsibility for many of these attacks, yet others still go unclaimed, leaving many unanswered questions. General Abdulmanan Farahi, head of the Counterterrorism Directorate of the Interior Ministry in the Afghan government.
Those who are responsible for these threats are mostly non-Afghans who are operating outside the boundaries of Afghanistan. Most of the terrorist threats are planned by foreigners, not Afghans.
A Kabul-based NGO, Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission spokesperson Ahmed Nader Naderi, says the government should be taking a more active role in making the country safe.
Government is weak, it's not able to project a level of strength and power, and it is in some places represented by the bad faces who the people does not like, and it does not present a picture that people would build confidence over and build trust in.
With this in mind, many are hoping that the upcoming presidential elections in Afghanistan will change things for the better. However, due to the turbulent security situation, some are questioning the possibility of even holding the elections in the spring of 2009, particularly in the volatile provinces like Helmand and Kunar. Haider Akbar is with the Center for Conflict and Peace Studies.
That being said, there's a lot of opportunity from now until the end of next year to change the security situation. And I think, given the importance of elections, especially for the international community, who's made a high priority on changing the political dynamics and political institutions in Afghanistan, basically the only success story we have sort of right now that we can tell the international community, and especially United States and others can tell, is elections.
Besides the security situation, civilian casualties have skyrocketed. According to recent figures released by the United Nations, August saw the highest number of deaths since the overthrow of the Taliban in 2001. The latest U.S. military's bombing of civilians has raised serious concern about the U.S. role in Afghanistan. According to the UN, those bombings killed 90 people, the majority of them women and children, in the Shindan district of the province of Herat. The U.S. has repeatedly denied the high numbers of casualties, insisting that only up to 7 civilians and about 35 militants were killed, and numerously calling for further investigations. Again, Ahmed Nader Naderi.
I was quite surprised to come with such a firm denial, because the incident happened in a highly populated village, and it's very hard to believe that the attacks were that precise, that only taken out a few combatants and did not affect the village.
However, since then, the U.S. military commended the operation as a successful attack against the Taliban. More recently, senior American commander in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, requested a review of the American military investigation. From Kabul, this is Asma Namadi for Free Speech Radio News.
The architects of the proposed $700 billion financial intervention appeared before Congress today. Lawmakers expressed skepticism of the need for rapid response, massive intervention. Administration officials said the risk is necessary. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Congress and the administration are continuing to hammer out details of a proposal that would authorize the Treasury Department to pump up to $700 billion into mortgage-backed and possibly other types of securities. The details of the plan are far from complete and seem to have made little progress since Monday, as lawmakers are becoming more skeptical as time passes. Lawmakers on the Senate Banking Committee had a face-to-face with the Secretary of the Treasury, the head of the Federal Reserve, and the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Here's Democrat Sherrod Brown of Ohio.
A man from Westerville, Ohio, was so concerned he took a day off work and drove to Washington this week, 7-hour drive, to share his views with me. He quite rightly asked why we're rushing to bail out companies whose leaders got rich by gambling with other people's money.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says taxpayers are already roped into Wall Street's financial problems.
Best thing we can do for all of them is to stabilize the financial markets so that people can continue to get loans. Small businesses can get loans. Small farmers in your states can get loans. Big farmers in your states can get loans.
As the hearing turned to the specifics of Paulson's plan, disagreement became apparent, including on the central component, how the $700 billion will be spent. Paulson says every situation will be different, but the idea is to buy bad securities through a reverse auction, where the companies wanting to get rid of securities come to the government with a price. Paulson says the markets will recover and the government could make some of its money back. But Senator Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, wanted added assurance. He wants the government to receive equity through warrants, a guarantee the company will pay the government back once the money was being made. Paulson says that idea would risk broad participation.
You're suggesting that these very brilliant financial people who are running these companies would risk the failure of their enterprise by not participating in this function because now we've imposed a contingent reimbursement to taxpayers.
Here's what I'm saying, and we will, that if if this, when we protect the taxpayer, the right way is to have the program work and have the assets appreciate when the economy appreciates. I'm saying that the model you are looking at is a model where we'd go to people that absolutely need to sell and say, if you want to sell, give us something. The model we're looking at is, and what we believe it takes to be successful here, is to go to a broad group of institutions and a very, very wide range of institutions that own these assets and have them participate.
One other way to describe what you just said is we go to some institutions that don't need help and we give them help for free.
Robin Hahnell is an economist at American University. He says Paulson, who is the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, will please Wall Street with his plan.
They basically get to unload all this totally, you know, they get to unload these values without asset, probably getting tremendously overpaid for it. And they don't even lose, you know, they don't have to dilute their stock ownership. If it works, their companies are back in business, and the money's all theirs.
Paulson also continues to oppose limits on the so-called golden parachute, capping top executives' compensation. He again cites the need for broad participation, alluding to the possibility that some companies won't participate if compensation is capped. Paulson also appears to reject the idea of including assistance to those with foreclosed homes. Paulson is questioned by the top Republican on the committee, Richard Shelby.
What does it do to the homeowner who's losing their home? And thank you, Senator Dodd, for you.
I would say what this plan will do is make financing available. And I don't think there's anything more important. Lenders have got to keep lending. If they're not lending and there's not capital available, homeowners aren't going to be able to stay in the home.
Another point of contention is the amount of control the Treasury Secretary will have. Secretary Paulson wants sole authority. He does not want to be told how to spend the money, and he wants no review by the courts, making him immune to oversight.
We're asking for is some broad powers with some good, strong oversight.
Congressional leaders have come up with ways to implement some, creating an independent oversight board and implementing reporting requirements. Another idea is to ban government employees from leaving their government job to work for the financial firms that will benefit from the program. Although Paulson says he agrees to oversight in theory, those details have not yet been worked out. Both Republicans and Democrats have indicated they won't accept the administration's proposal as is. It looks less likely that legislation will be passed before the end of the week, a deadline imposed by the executive branch. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Chile's part of Patagonia is one of the last areas on the planet virtually untouched by human encroachment. It's also home to the world's last freshwater reservoir. But a proposed mega hydroelectric dam project may change its landscape and environment forever. A plan to build 5 dams on the Pascua and Baker rivers has created controversy and strong opposition from local residents and environmentalists, large and small businesses, and the local Catholic Church. FSRN's Jorge Garitón has more from Santiago.
A company called Hydro Aysén plans to stop the Baker River at 2 locations and the Pascua River at 3 to construct 5 hydroelectric power dams by the year 2020. The company is offering an average of 18,430 gigawatts per hour for this energy-starving country. But not all are happy. Some Patagonia residents opposed the dams because they could ruin high-end wilderness tourism and other environmentally friendly economic development. The dams will flood large tracts of evergreen Patagonian rainforest, threatening a 1,000-year-old ecosystem. Flavia Liberona is with the Patagonia Without Dams Coalition, an alliance of environmentalist civil society groups and small and large businesses.
Nos parece bastante cuestionable que
We find it questionable that a region of the country that's part of the Chilean Patagonia, that has important environmental traits of national and world interest, is used as an energy-generating machine for industry and mining interests. We find it, as an energy plan, sheer lunacy. We do not have a strategic view of the nation, of how it will develop, generate, and distribute energy.
Liberona says that the coalition met with Hydro Aysén to discuss their objections, but was told the company will go ahead because of the lucrative earning prospects. The company plans to spend more than $3 billion and to build a 1,400-mile-long transmission line. This would be the world's largest single one-way constant current transmission line. If Hydro Aysén is able to build the dams, the two electricity utility companies that own it will control 90% of Chile's electricity generation market. But first, they need the green light from Chile's environmental agency. The final decision rests on the hands of government ministers, and some are on record as showing their support for the Patagonia Dam project. However, pro-government Senator Guido Girardi says the dams are not the solution and Chile has to invest in renewable energy like sun, wind, sea tides and thermal sources.
Lo que hay acá es el desarrollo de una...
What we have here is not the country's strategic energy needs, but rather the short-term interest of private business.
Estamos hablando de un país que tiene hoy día una matriz instalada.
Today, Chile has an energy matrix of 12 to 13 megawatts, and like all countries in the world, Chile needs to develop its energy resources that are important to the country's growth. But in Chile, we have a problem. Our energy growth is above the current economic needs.
Girardi blames a dominant market view of public policy. He says the government has to intervene to change the energy matrix by taking control away from market forces and let the government dictate long-term energy policy. In business circles, the Patagonia dams are seen as essential to East Chile's growing energy demands. The dean of the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Chile, Felipe Morandé, says the project is needed because of the sheer energy output.
Those are big numbers, and those are the numbers that will put the electricity supply in the future in agreement with the economic growth of the country. According to what we know today, that is something that we need. Of course, they have to be complying with all the environmental regulations. I see that as a very good project for what we need in the country, which is to double our energy generation in 10 years.
FSRN's repeated requests for an interview with Hydro Aysén officials were turned down. It is too early to predict what will happen to the Fai Dam project, but both support and opposition are growing. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send your feedback to comments at fsrn.org. That's comments at fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Kitapchi, and Oscar Hernandez. Our interns are Robert Loza and Peter Steen. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandasizwe Shimaringa, sitting in for Aura Bogado.